What is Russia doing right now as we talk?
What Russia is doing is they're acknowledging the comprehensive realities on the battlefield. They see that they are continuing to expand their armed forces. They're continuing to recruit, not mobilize, but recruit more per month than they lose. They have kind of changed the way they operate in that with their conscription, their annual conscription that they have, their use of the reserve forces. They appear to be expanding the base of that while keeping the number of actual combatants in the Ukraine theater somewhere around 700,000. So it's a relatively steady state. However many troops they lose, they put that many more in there, but they're obviously growing more than that. And they appear to be training up a much bigger base. So in the event that there is this global war or even a continental war, a European war, that they have all of the manpower that they need to swamp everything in the West. And of course, simultaneously with that, they're also expanding their defense industrial base. They are dramatically ramping up their storage of all of the key weapon systems that you need, drones, long-range missiles, rockets, missiles of other types, et cetera, certainly the artillery shells. All of those categories, by all accounts, are being stockpiled in large, large numbers because they're still using them in somewhere around 3+ to 1 advantage on the front line. So they're still maintaining that pretty sizable advantage, but they're stockpiling them more to make it possible on a conventional level that if there is any conflict later on, that they can win it decisively, because the West, for all of its talk, is doing nothing but spending a lot of money on a few high-tech weapon systems and categories of ammunition, but it's incremental. And they're looking at maybe 2030, et cetera, and I doubt seriously they're going to get there either. So that's what Russia's kind of doing. Meanwhile, on the front line itself, they see that the other half of that equation that I just talked about, Ukraine cannot force mobilize enough people to offset the losses they have, which are profound, much orders of magnitude higher. The most rational, logical number I can get is somewhere around 10 casualties on the Ukraine side for everyone on the Russian side. Some suggest it's up to 20. I think that's an exaggeration, but 10 seems pretty logical given the evidence that we have here. Ukraine doesn't have enough men to replace the losses. Those that they do force mobilize, some meaningful percentage of them abandon the fight and they just run away, AWOL, whatever term you want to use. And then, of course, there's the casualties that they absorb on a daily basis. Meanwhile, simultaneously to that, the defense industrial base, while they do the best they can to have their own domestic arms industry, because Russia has an almost unlimited ability to strike everywhere and throughout the depth of their country, those factories are constantly getting hit. The electricity systems getting hit, the power systems to generate electricity, heat, everything else is constantly being knocked out. So you can't physically function if you don't have, you know, enough energy. And generators can help, but they just mitigate the process. Meanwhile, the Europeans are not providing enough because it's not a wartime footing for them. They're not actually on a wartime footing. They're on a little bit more than they were in peacetime, but it's not going to be enough. It's never going to be enough. You're never going to offset what the Russians are doing here. So Russia sees, I don't need to have these big offensive operations that will cause a spike in my friendly casualties, but could end the war quicker. They seem content to just, you know what, I'm going to let NATO keep bleeding its resources. I'm going to let the Ukraine keep bleeding its men. And we're going to lead not with manpower, but with firepower. And we're going to use artillery. We're going to use FPV drones. We're going to use the bomber drones. We're going to use these new glide bombs that now have additional technology that can now almost double the range from what they were just 1 year ago. They have what appears to be a near limitless number of them. They have new categories of the long-range drones. They are having more of the missiles that are getting through. And by one American account that I saw that's very much pro-Ukraine the other day, he admitted that the Ukrainians report that they're getting 20% of the missiles. I don't know if they're actually getting that many, especially these hypersonics, but that tells you 80% of them are finding their targets and you have no answer for it. The West has no answer for it. So what does all of that mean? That means that Russia is on a glide path to grinding down the Ukrainian armed forces until at some point they physically break because there just aren't enough of them. And at that point, Russia doesn't have to fight for every city. They can just drive to wherever they want to go because there won't be fortifications. There won't be people to man the fortifications they have. And the morale continues to drop. So this is on a glide path to a military victory for Russia. Because, and by the way, one of the reasons I love your show, Dialogue Works, it does. And it has been absolutely abandoned by the West writ large, not just the U.S. And so we could have had dialogue to bring this to an end a lot longer, a long time ago. It would have preserved hundreds of thousands of Ukraine men for the future, territory, cities, all of that stuff. Because we have refused to have a negotiated settlement at any point, we, the West, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, have condemned Ukraine to a military defeat. And Russia appears content to just let it go on without increasing the risk of their troops. And they will go until at some point you have this collapse. That's where we're headed.
Carl, is Russia preparing or is in the process of establishing the buffer zone? You know, I'm talking about Odessa, Nikolaev, going up to Kharkov. And how do you find the buffer zone that Russia is trying to make between, you know, the eastern and the western part of Ukraine?
Yeah, I know. I know that many of the Russian analysts and spokespeople have talked about a buffer zone. Obviously, you have some in Sumy. You have some in Kharkiv Oblast. They've actually increased it over the last several months. But not by a large amount here. I think that that's a secondary, maybe even a tertiary operation, maybe in certain zones or something to keep Belgorod, for example, you know, try to move the line back far enough from that to limit the ability to launch artillery strikes or something. But I think that their overwhelming focus is on destroying the Ukrainian armed forces as an entity. And so they're going to just continue along that huge front from Zaporizhia all the way up to Kharkiv. And I think that they're just going to continue on with that. And then that will eventually form its own buffer, because then I think once you have a collapse and a break, then I think the Russians go just drive up to the Dnieper River. They probably seize Odessa. Maybe you don't even have to fight for it. You might just seize it, probably link up with Transnistria in the south, and might even go almost right up to the gates of Kiev itself and just take everything to the east of that. I think that's going to be their buffer.
Is Trump still pursuing ceasefire?
No. He's the only ceasefire he's ever produced is, hey, I just want the fighting to stop because I don't like it. And I want to get credit for a so-called war that we've ended, even though I don't think that he's actually ended a single one of them. He had a handful of conversations with some people who were working to have some ceasefires, but it's, in my view, completely fraudulent to suggest that he ended any wars. He didn't even understand the situations in any of this. He just wants credit for stuff. So he would love to have credit for this one to add to what he perceives as a feather in his cap, but he's never had any realistic scenario for it, because there was some on the table. He could have had some if he'd have been willing to knuckle down and put some hard decisions on both Europe and Ukraine, but he wasn't willing to do that. So he just said, I just want y'all to stop just where you're at. And then subsequent to that, he'll say, but then sometimes you just got to fight it out. So he has no idea what he's doing. He doesn't even know what he wants. He changes the story like a ping pong table. It's got to be making people dizzy over there on both sides of the line of contact. But the Russians, I think, have finally just said, yeah, we're not going to listen to what he says. We're just going to do what we're going to do and talk to you on the other side.
Who's providing Donald Trump with the information? Because we had the meeting between Donald Trump and Putin in Alaska, and he said in the aftermath of the meeting, immediately, he said that ceasefire is gone. You have to find a permanent solution for what's going on. Then he went to the United Kingdom. He came back and said, he came to the same sort of rhetoric. Ceasefire is important. Who's running the show in Ukraine, Carl? When it comes to the battlefield, when it comes to the intelligence, it seems to me that the United States under the Trump administration handed it over to the British. Is that the case, or you still see?
I don't have any insider information to give you authoritative answers, but I have come to the same conclusion that you did, that the British, maybe even a consortium of the British, French, and German have kind of together come up with this. And of course, the EU leadership and Ursula von der Leyen, Kaja Kallas, I think that kind of that group themselves have been kind of running the show. Zelensky's, enthusiastic about everything they say, even though it's detached from reality and can only have his country destroyed. It shouldn't give him any excitement, but it does. So I think that those people are, and I think that their head spins just as much as Vladimir Putin's does about what comes out of Washington, because it just changes all the time. And, I think that they're as detached from reality as Trump is, just in a different way and with the same catastrophic result for the Ukrainian people. And I think that history is going to be very, very bitter to all of the Western leadership. And you can go all the way back to Joe Biden and just roll it within a straight line to the current president. And it's going to be bad for us all.
Yeah. And before wrapping up, I know that you have to leave us, but Carl, looking at the Middle East today, we had a 12-day war between Israel and Iran. And it seems that Israel is getting prepared, not only fighting Iran, but also in Lebanon. And Netanyahu yesterday said they don't need the United States. They can, you know, they're independent. They can decide about their, you know, country, that what would be the policy, the strategy of Israel. But if they attack Iran again, on the part of Iranians, we've learned 2 days ago from one of the officials, military officials in Iran, they said if Israel attacks Iran, they're going to attack, hit Israel with 20,000 at the same time missiles. And what is happening in Washington in terms of just calming down the situation in the Middle East, making some sort of decisions that nobody wants this war?
That's not true. You can't say nobody. Israel most definitely wants the war. They definitely do. No one should want the war. Not many other people want the war, but Israel clearly does. And listen, if you weren't looking at any headlines, if you weren't listening or reading any news, and you're just looking on the ground at what's happening here, in my estimation, there was no ceasefire. It was a piece of paper only. It was a headline. It was a bunch of celebrations. You had a temporary ceasefire and a hostage exchange between the two sides. And almost after that, and since that time, I don't think you can say there's been a ceasefire. The Israeli side has continued to operate in both the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank and in Lebanon. And they've just continued to fight. It's hardly reduced from where it was before that. And you know, you talk about what Iran's going to do. I rarely use the term the 12-day war, because there was a 12-day flashpoint, and then the gun stopped because everybody had motivation for it. The thing didn't end. No conditions and terms were met. They just stopped fighting because it suited all of them for the moment. But I think that the Israeli side has this obsession with defeating Iran, and I just can't imagine them then suddenly stop, just like I can't imagine them suddenly stopping in the Gaza Strip and just allowing this moonscape of a land that they have created, and then just that's it, and just we're going to stop, and just we're going to rebuild it, and the same problems are going to exist, except now it's profoundly worse because of the deep seed soaked in blood of future violence in the region. Because if you don't give the Palestinian people some kind of a hope that they didn't have prior to 10/7/2023, it's going to be on steroids the next time it explodes. And I think the Israelis know that. So I think they have not given up on somehow cleansing the place, and they're just looking for a pretext to get that done. I just don't think they've given up on it. And that includes and extends to Iran. Now, I had not seen that statement by Iran, but I will tell you that my analysis, again, just a military analysis of the situation, I was concerned for Israel that when they attacked Iran in a large scale, that Iran would do exactly what he said they would do, because the Israeli Iron Dome system had already been shown in 2024 to be nowhere near as good as what they claimed that it would be. And if you had these barrages, not, you know, 300 or 400 missiles and drones come in a period of time, but 1,000 come in, and then 20 minutes later, another 1,000 come in, and then another 45 minutes, another 1,000, et cetera. If you just had wave after wave of thousands, the Iron Dome would be exhausted, even what little it can actually knock down, which is far less than what is being claimed. You're going to run out of interceptor missiles like that, and then all of a sudden, the sixth and seventh waves come in, you got nothing, and you could literally be wiped out. But then, of course, you have the prospect that Israel would not wait for that seventh or eighth round. They would launch a nuclear weapon. And that's why the region could just explode. And I think that Iran knows that. And so I think that's probably why they didn't do that the first time, and why they might not do it the second time. But this time they might do a couple of these big waves because they want to keep it on this side of the threshold, because, you know, if a nuclear weapon is used, they got no answer for that. So this could still just explode for all of mankind, and one of the reasons I'm very worried about it.
You know what's amazing to me, that how a country of 8 million people are thinking that they can fight a country of 91 million.
Because they have America over their shoulder. That's the reason. With that, he says he, Netanyahu, you said, claimed that he could do it without. Let him try. But fine. You think you can do it? You think you can do it without the nonstop ammunition that we have, without the political cover, without the diplomatic cover? You think you can do that on your own? Have at it. Because I suspect very strongly you would find very quickly that you cannot do it by yourself. And then you have bit off more than you could chew. And you may find out that all of a sudden you've created a lot other enemies in just in sheer numbers that could overwhelm you. And then again, puts everybody at the brink of a potential nuclear escalation. We're all thinking it's going to be Russia or China that could start something like this. And it turns out it could be our own so-called ally in Israel if things go badly there. I'm more worried about nuclear escalation in the Middle East from Israel than I am from either of the other two superpowers. Wow.
Thank you so much, Carl, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
My pleasure. And you just keep on going with this dialogue because it still works. It's still the only thing that can solve these problems. Because if we go down the military path, some dark version of what I've said here is probably going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Carl.
See you next time.
See you next time.